I'm happy to be addressing you from Calvin College, which has helped me to support me this year in a program called the Calvin Lectureship, in which I've been commissioned to be available to go out on the road and present in various lectures to different sorts of university audiences some examples of Christian thought at work within the disciplines. My own discipline, of course, is in physics, and within physics, my own specialty, as you've heard, is in atomic and optical physics. But for the purposes of this lectureship, I'm adopting a wider point of view and taking as my subjects facets of physics and of science in general that I hope are of broader appeal to scientists and to other thinkers, facets better illustrating those features of the scientific process which interact with or depend upon presuppositions or other assumptions connected with philosophy and theology. Now, some of you know that there's been a long argument about these such presuppositions and whether they are at all legitimate within or perhaps underneath science, or whether they are, on the contrary, something that is dispensable in the scientific process, dispensable as a historical curiosity, perhaps the necessary swaddling clothes of science in its infancy, but now long overdue to be shed as science reaches a vigorous maturity. The century just ended has included a long discussion within the philosophy of science of the role of presuppositions. And if I may say so, from my own training, even at Calvin College, the whole of science, right up to the textbooks from which most of us were taught our science, have been, in the century just past, heavily influenced by the philosophical school called positivism, which held that all of science could be based on, and could be based on, nothing other than the empirically verifiable findings of open-minded and disinterested scientists, with emphasis on empirical verifiability. This rather appealing outlook was motivated in part by the observable fact of a nearly unanimous convergence of belief in various fields of science, especially by contrast to a lack of convergence in other fields, for example, history and politics and you name it, by the absence within science of national schools of belief, by the many successes of the scientific process in reaching, if not some sort of capital T truth, then at least reliable knowledge that possessed an undoubted claim on the credence of any scientist willing to accept empirical data. The hope of positivists, I think I can say fairly, was that this sort of scientific convergence was both normal and normative. Normal in that it could be hoped to occur soon in every branch and area of science, and in fact in every area of human knowledge, and normative in that it was held by the positive position that any area of knowledge depending upon or influenced by extra scientific presuppositions was to that very extent a species of false knowledge, unscientific, and to that extent unworthy of credibility. Now, given the way scientists are trained, I think it generally comes as a surprise to them, or at least the ones of my age, when they are told by people now working in philosophy that the positivist project has been largely abandoned by philosophers of science. It's been largely judged by philosophers to have been a failure, both in its own internal logic and in its external application to the actual facts of scientific inquiry. But I'm not a philosopher, so I'm not going to spend any time here today explaining how this defeat of positivism on its home ground came actually to occur in detail. But rather, I'm going to stick to what scientific credentials I may possess to show you that, contrary to the hope or expectation of positivists, contrary to what I might call the positivist dream, that presuppositions do in fact, and in some cases must in fact forever, play an essential role right inside the process of science. Well, here we go. We live in a scientific age. We've become accustomed to expecting and even depending on scientific explanations for all sorts of things, such as the motions of the planets and their very origins, the combinations of molecules and their nature, the mechanisms of disease and their cures. We expect a scientific explanation for every part and parcel of the behavior of the natural world. But what about the natural world as a whole, the whole universe, the whole cosmos? The scientific description of the history and destiny of the material world is the subject area of the science of cosmology. And today I'd like to take you through two case studies in cosmology, chosen not only for their scientific interest, and I think relatively broad popular appeal, but also for the light they shed on the process of science. In particular, I hope to show you something of the roles that philosophical preferences and metaphysical presuppositions have played and which continue to play in cosmology. So, my first case study is the story of cosmological time, or the cosmological age, the process by which it's come to be generally accepted that our universe is not eternal, but had an origin, and that its age is not infinite, but in fact a mere 14 or so billion years. I have to mention that the scientific contemplation of the origin of the universe is surprisingly recent, and its scientific respectability is more recent still. This arena was always conceded to philosophers, theologians, and mythographers, and always had within the scientific community the aroma of unbridled speculation about it, and was shunned by strict empiricists for a variety of reasons right up into modern times. Cosmology as an acceptable scientific discipline is scarcely older than I am. Let me remind you of the process by which this scientific respectability came to be attained. The first impetus came not from within physics, by the way, but from geology, because its indications that the Earth was old, very old, and that the Earth itself showed evidence of a long, involved, and systematic history. Physicists were not nearly as eager to admit to the existence of what geologists came to call deep time. And it was only around 1900, with the discovery of radioactivity, that physicists found a way either to date the Earth's chronology as long, or to power the sun's energy output to run the whole project during that long time. So that's on the indications from geology. What's more, while the size and the dynamics of the solar system had been understood since the time of Kepler and Newton, the nature of our galaxy was settled only in the 1920s, as recently as the 1920s, with the realization that while the Milky Way we see overhead is our view of our own galaxy, the so-called galactic nebulae we see with suitable telescopes were other, separate, distant, and co-equal galaxies with our own. So this was the first glimpse of the scale of the universe in space. The discovery of its scale in time came soon after with Edwin Hubble's famous discovery that the external galaxies were receding from our own. And the further discovery that the more distant the galaxy, the more rapidly it was receding from our own. Right from the beginning, this has always been interpreted as indicating an overall expansion of the universe. While perhaps in a pre-Copernican age, it would have been thought natural to assume the Earth at rest and in the center of this universal tellurophobia, in our time, a mixture of empirical evidence and a generically Copernican outlook inclined almost everyone to deny to the Earth, or indeed to our own galaxy, any sort of special place or state of rest, and instead has led to a picture of an overall expansion of the whole universe with no galaxy occupying a special place, but all of them receding from all the others in a universal expansion. The idea that the expansion was truly universal came to be called the cosmological principle, which stated that the appearance of the universe would be, broadly speaking, the same for observations from any point in space within it. The cosmological principle, in a Copernican fashion, denies any special place to the Earth. Now, with the existence of external galaxies and with the observation of some form of universal expansion, reasonably well established as empirical facts about the cosmos, there came to be two quite antithetical schools of theory, of theorizing about how this situation could obtain. The first of these schools sought to elevate the rather Copernican cosmological principle to an even more appealing and symmetrical extension, which came to be called the perfect cosmological principle, or the perfected cosmological principle, which held that the appearance of the universe would be, broadly speaking, not only the same for observations from any point in space within it, but also the same for observations from any point in time within it. This principle would not only deny to our Earth or our galaxy any special place within the cosmos, but would also deny that we fall in any special time in the universe's history. Naturally, this principle would be empirically inconsistent with the observed expansion of the universe unless another assumption were also made, because the ongoing expansion of the universe would otherwise inevitably predict a future of ever smaller density and would retrodict a past of ever greater density of galaxies, contradicting the perfect cosmological principle. So theorists in this school were willing to invoke what came to be called a continuous creation of matter with the otherwise sacrosanct law of conservation of mass, for example, systematically violated to allow or even require the continuous, if slow, spontaneous appearance of matter, perhaps a trifling production rate of hydrogen atoms born in otherwise empty space, to replace the matter that would otherwise be eternally diluted by the expansion of the universe. And the combination of the perfect cosmological principle and this continuous creation of matter led to a picture that came to be called the steady state model of the universe. Now, part of the motivation for this hypothesis of a perfect cosmological principle, I think it's fair to say, came quite directly from an unpalatable consequence of an otherwise unpalatable consequence of the empirically observed expansion of the universe. Since both the present scale of the universe and the present rate of its expansion are accessible and empirically measurable quantities, it's an easy exercise, perfectly consistent with the idea of the universal applicability of natural law to the behavior of matter, to extrapolate the expansion backwards in time to that epoch at which the galaxies were all together, at that time when the expansion might be said to have just started. Now, while getting the actual numerical value for that the time back to that age of the universe original event was to take longer than was first expected, this line of thought right at the beginning was sure to lead to two conclusions. One, that the universe was of a finite age, an age of order of billions or dozens of billions of years, but by no means infinite. And two, that the past of the universe was not like the present or the future, but very different, with some sort of explosive initial expansion from some sort of origin of something like infinite density. And this alternative viewpoint, unpalatable to those who held the perfect cosmological principle, was derisively labeled by its opponents the Big Bang theory of the universe. That was meant to be a mocking name for the theory. Now, there's been a fair amount of study of the motivations that lay behind opposition to a Big Bang outlook on universal history. But one of the motivations was quite frankly expressed then, and by some still now. The perfect cosmological principle neatly removes, and by design, if you will, neatly removes, right out of the realm of empirical science, any need to assign either an origin or a creation to the universe as a whole. That's the merit, in certain eyes, of the steady state model of the universe, expressed with perfect frankness to me by one of the scholars in the field. I don't know how frankly in print. The principle of the perfect cosmological principle, by the way, was in perfect continuity with a philosophical tradition dating back far longer than science itself, dating back at least as far as the Epicureans, and continuing, by the way, in Marxist dogma right into our own times, of the eternity of matter, the dogma of the eternity of matter, and the concomitant dogma of the non-finiteness of the universe. Now, I don't know that a poll was ever taken, say around 1960, among the scientists contending between the steady state and Big Bang views of cosmology, but there is no doubt that the perfect cosmological principle was appealing to scientists of what you might call a philosophical materialist school, not only for its mathematical symmetry and its predictive value, but also for its explicit avoidance of any question of an origin or a creation or even a creator of the universe. Now, I've referred to the second contending school, the school which, like the Whigs and Tories of English political history, came to embrace the label first assigned them by their opponents. These fellows, of course, came to be called Big Bang cosmologists, and surprisingly, they came to prevail over their opponents. In this context, I don't think it's appropriate for me to go into the details of how this episode in the history of science came to this resolution, except to say that it provides a very fine case in which empirical observations, compared with the definite predictions of two competing theories, came to prevail over the clearly expressed philosophical predispositions of many of the very scientists involved. There were plenty of scientists who preferred the steady state model on philosophical grounds, who eventually abandoned it on empirical grounds. Without any real change in metaphysical assumptions, without any breakthrough in philosophical thought, in this case, I claim, the mere and ordinary processes of science led to several conclusions. One, that the universe is only finitely old, contrary to the Epicurean tradition, and had an origin event, called the Big Bang to this day. Two, that there's no need, therefore, to appeal to any continuous creation of matter, so that various beloved conservation laws could, after all, be maintained. And three, and again, contrary to dogma, that there's no reason to believe in any such thing as a perfect cosmological principle, but rather that there's clear empirical evidence that the universe was hot, dense, and very different than our universe at the present day. And quite apart from all these by now well-accepted conclusions in cosmology, I think we have in this whole episode a very fine counterexample to the claim that we sometimes hear expressed in our own time that scientific conclusions should always be suspected as being ideologically predetermined. Predetermined by, say, the philosophical presuppositions of the proponents of them. Or, from a Marxist point of view, from the class standing of the proponents of them, or from a more modern dispute determined by the gender or the status of privilege of the proponents of them. I won't pretend that everyone involved was persuaded by the empirical evidence. I should mention that Sir Fred Hoyle, who coined the mocking term the Big Bang for his the opposing theory, died just this past year, unconverted by the empirical evidence to his last breath. And by the way, the Chinese Communist Party dogma to this very day is firmly set on the philosophical grounds of dialectical materialism against what it calls, and not by way of compliment, the idealistic view of a universe finite in time. Idealism is a civic virtue in North America, but in China it's anti-materialist and therefore heterodox. Anyway, apart from holdouts such as Hoyle, which represents a sociological normal accompaniment of any scientific revolution, by the way, let me back up. But such holdouts as Hoyle are a sociologically normal accompaniment in any scientific revolution, even if the existence of this holdout phenomenon is a little hard to understand from the point of view of positivism. So I won't talk about the few holdouts. I won't talk further about the empirical evidence in this particular case of the steady state versus Big Bang contending theories of cosmology. What I want to do now is to turn from my case study of cosmological time, one that is now, by this time, largely settled, and settled, as I claim, by the normal methods of empirical science, I want to turn, in other words, to my second case study, and this one I'll call the case of cosmological fine-tuning, perhaps more interesting because the dispute is going on right now, and it's a dispute in which philosophical predispositions are visibly playing an even more prominent role than in the previous dispute of my first case study. The scientific question of fine-tuning addresses not the age of the universe, as in the previous case study, but rather addresses the habitability of the universe on its fitness or even its apparent predisposition, not just for the mere existence of life, but even for the existence of thinking, reflective, sentient life, capable even to the extent of cosmological theorizing. Now, in this case, there's no question about the evidence. Our own existence, right here in this room, is, I hope, part of the empirical evidence that there's thinking, reflective life in the universe. The question is about the significance of that evidence. Now, I have to mention that from a materialist point of view, this question of fine-tuning, has an even more unpleasant odor than the finiteness of the universe. Hard as it might be for some persons to accept a universe of finite age in contradiction to the Epicurean dogma, and to accept that the universe had an origin in time, or as St. Augustine first had it better said, an origin with time, it's harder still, I claim, for a materialist to accept the idea that the processes of the material world acting on and through the inconceivably hot and dense matter of the primordial universe, as they must have, could in any sense be said to have had life in mind as a goal, or even a possibility. And while there is, again, a long prehistory of theological and philosophical speculation on the idea of the suitability of the universe as a home for life, even to the extent of a belief that this universe represents the best of all possible worlds, the Copernican view, likely to be held by scientists of a materialist bent, is, of course, that human life occupies a planet whose place is in some sense not at all special. And this Copernican view lends itself, along this materialist line of thought, to a corollary view that life itself is neither an essential nor in any sense an intended facet of the existence of the material universe. And for this reason, I think it's been very instructive for me to follow an emerging debate in cosmology that's collected several labels. One of the headings under which you find it conducted is the so-called anthropic principle. Another one is usually just called the fine-tuning argument. The central question in this discussion is, as I said, the significance of life in the universe and what import that existence of life has for cosmological theorizing. And I'd like to identify two antithetical schools of thought with quite different outlooks about the existence of life. I'd like to call them, to coin two terms, the accidentalist and the specialist schools of thought. The accidentalist school is entirely in line in its sympathies and its predispositions with a view as old as the Epicureans, the view that life is in some sense both natural and accidental to the universe, that life is a phenomenon so likely to emerge spontaneously from nature that no special significance is to be assigned to its admittedly obvious existence. In fact, lest the single known case of life in the universe, namely that on Earth, lest that case indicate anything so invidiously singular as a special phenomenon, the accidentalist school is always eager to insist, and revealingly, quite in advance of the evidence, to insist that life must be common in the universe, that it can, will, nay, must emerge in any and every niche open at all to its existence. By contrast, the other school I'm calling the specialist camp is much more tied to, frankly, religious presuppositions because it's much more likely to remark on all the special features necessary if the universe is to be at all habitable, at all conducive to the emergence or sustenance of life. This specialist camp will certainly include those inclined to view life in general, and human life in particular, as special creations rather than random emergences. And this specialist camp is not logically committed to the rarity of life in the universe, though it is more inviting to those who think that either life in any form, or more especially sentient self-reflective life, is so special as likely to be rare. What has been quite remarkable in just the last decade has been to see a discussion conducted by scientists working within their own disciplines, not out of philosophy or theology, a discussion which has lent, on scientific grounds, much more credibility to the specialist argument than was typically assigned it, even as recently as 1990, when, I must say, the accidentalist dogma reigned virtually without exception. Let me sketch some of the evidence that has led to what I consider this surprising turn of events. Of course, you can find a very large mixed bag of such discussions if you work on any internet search engine under the category fine-tuning. But the basic argument of the fine-tuning school is that there are just too many coincidences, just too many factors that have to be just right, just too many things about the universe that could so easily have been otherwise for the life occurring within it to be in any sense an accident. Oddly enough, Fred Hoyle, the namer and first detractor of the Big Bang Theory, was also the discoverer of one of the very first fine-tuning arguments that was at all appealing to physicists. He noted, for example, that the existence of the chemical elements in general and of carbon and oxygen in particular is, first of all, a requirement for any chemistry at all consonant with the existence of life. And secondly, the existence of carbon and oxygen is a very contingent fact given any sort of cosmological theory. On almost any cosmological theory, it turns out that while the existence of hydrogen and helium is in some sense natural or expected, all the rest of matter, the atoms that make up so much of our surroundings, including our bodies and brains, is a manufactured product, made not by any primordial process, originating not from any creation event, but derived subsequently, and in a sort of manufactured kind of way, derived from nuclear fusion reactions in the center of certain kinds of stars. What's more, the details of this nucleosynthesis process that makes all the other chemical elements out of hydrogen and helium turns out to be apparently specially devised, as if arranged to make the production of carbon atoms out of three helium atoms possible instead of fantastically unlikely. In an episode whose sequence was deeply influential to physicists, Hoyle, whose predispositions, by the way, were firmly in the steady state and Epicurean camp, Hoyle was able to argue from the undoubted existence of carbon and its production in stars that the detailed structure of the nucleus, beryllium-8, would include a feature called a resonance, which would lend a somewhat less fleeting existence to this highly unstable and short-lived species that exists in the center of certain stars. And lo, it was so. Subsequent terrestrial investigation of beryllium-8 found that this resonance, the existence of which had been hypothesized on the basis of the need to assume it because of the undoubted existence of carbon, that this resonance really did exist in fact. Hoyle's emotional involvement in this episode was sufficient for even him to wonder whether it pointed to a universe as, what he called it, a put-up job, a custom arrangement, as if intended to make possible within it the production of heavy elements. Now, what was an isolated curiosity in the details of nucleosynthesis in this episode has come to be a pattern in the last 10 years as scientists look over the whole material basis of life and come to discover not just this one, but all sorts of things that had to be just so for life to be a possibility at all. I have to point out that some of these many fine-tuning factors can be robustly accommodated by an evolutionary view of life without their assigning doing any damage to the accidentalist camp. For example, it's been remarked that the Earth is at the just right, the Goldilocks distance from the Sun for liquid water to exist here. Farther out and the water would all freeze and stay frozen. Farther in and the water would all boil away within geological time. So we're neither too hot nor too cold, but just right, like Goldilocks porridge. And arguments like this, initially remarkable, might be called Goldilocks occurrences, because the accidentalist camp would retort that of course living things will remark on the Goldilocks character of their environments. Because after all, first of all, they're evolved to be adapted to them, and second, if their environments were to be, or even to become, too severe for life to emerge or continue to exist, why then, of course, there'd be no reflective organisms to contemplate their own non-existence. So while there have come to be any number of observations that our solar system, for example, is felicitously set up to make life not only possible, but also potentially long-lasting, I think the arguments that best evade the Goldilocks label are those arising not in solar system history, but in cosmology, because they apply not to life in our particular environment, but to the mere contingent existence of there being any environments at all in the whole universe in which life could ever emerge or continue to exist. And I have to point out that arguments like this, fine-tuning arguments for the universe as a whole, are surprisingly effective. Their typical structure goes like this. Whatever else a Big Bang is, it's the emergence of matter and energy governed by a small set of universal laws. Such laws are predictive and quantitative, and they describe what particles there will be, with what forces they'll interact, and how strong are these forces. In fact, the laws form a sort of script, and the matter and energy formed in that Big Bang then obediently follow the script to yield the outcome of a one working model universe. But it has to be pointed out that the few laws, governed by the few choices, as in the strengths of various forces, can yield, upon varying these few strength coefficients, a bewildering variety of model universes, many of them stillborn, most of them hopelessly inimical to the existence of stars, galaxies, planets, life-friendly environments, or even to the existence of matter itself. For example, an apparently trifling change in the strength of the mutual gravitational attraction that matter experiences can yield, in a universe described by otherwise unchanged laws, a universe in which stars, for example, either evolve so coolly and slowly as never to produce or distribute any of the necessary chemical elements to form the basis of planets and all living things, or alternatively, a universe in which stars evolve so quickly and so explosively as to yield no niches at all, both quiet and long-lasting enough for any life plausibly to evolve. This sort of argument, I claim, might be called the revenge of Goldilocks, because this fine-tuning applies not to our parochial neighborhood of Earth and our solar system, not to evolution of life on Earth, but to the entire universe. It could as a whole have been, in Goldilocks' famous phrase, either too hot or too cold, but it's just right. So powerful are these fine-tuning arguments that scientists wholly unsympathetic to specialist explanations have nevertheless taken them with the utmost seriousness. I myself was quite skeptical of fine-tuning arguments because of my upbringing as a Christian believer who knew all along, long before I knew any science, that this is our Father's world, and for whom it was no surprise to find that it was compatible and with the existence of and friendly to the existence of life. But it's a materialist who finds the arguments so striking because so unexpected. For example, the British cosmologist Martin Rees has recently published a book called Just Six Numbers. in which he points out that just six numbers appearing in the fundamental scientific laws serve to define almost fully what sort of universe will arise in obedience to those scientific laws, and further observes that these six numbers are fine-tuned in each case in our universe to make it habitable. Rees is no specialist and does not make this argument out of any philosophical predisposition to a creation or to a creator, but rather can fairly be said to have been driven to it by the empirical evidence. Arguments like the one in just six numbers are nevertheless quite unpersuasive to other members of the accidentalist school, by the way. One counter-argument I've read invites you to imagine yourself the incipient victim of a firing squad who nevertheless survives because, as it happens, all six rifles aimed at you happen, on this occasion, to misfire. The counter-argument goes, of course, if you pursue this line of thought, it must be that all six rifles failed to fire, else you wouldn't be around to conduct the inquiry. And so, of course, Rees's just six numbers had to be what they are, else there'd be no life, no reflective beings around to conduct the inquiry into their values. But the counter-argument concedes, of course, with the counter-argument that all six rifles did, in fact, fail to fire, and that they had to fail to fire for the prisoner to have the leisure to conduct the subsequent inquiry. It merely goes on to say that to observe that all six rifles failed to fire is not the same, not at all the same, either scientifically or emotionally, to explain why all six rifles failed to fire. You want to know, not just that they did fail to fire, but why they failed to fire. Anyway, given then the growing persuasiveness of fine-tuning arguments, not only to frankly theistic scientists, whose attraction to them can be discounted because of the visible axe to grind desirability of the conclusions in this school, but the persuasiveness of these arguments also to overtly materialistic scientists who are backed into them in some sense by serious contemplation of the empirical facts and their theoretical implications, I'd like now to follow up what we see made of fine-tuning arguments by those people who do not understand them as an expected consequence of a doctrine of creation, in which, of course, the fitness of the cosmos for the existence of matter, life, thought, and reflection are and always have been seen as the outworking of the intentions of a creator of nature. How can the evidence be interpreted by materialists in any other way? I think you have to see here the starkness of the choices available to anyone not falling into what I've called the specialist school. For the accidentalist, there are, as far as I can tell, only three choices. And to use the language of poker, they are, one, to fold, to concede that the empirical data point unambiguously to the special character of our own universe. Or two, to bluff, by claiming that despite its extreme improbability, our universe just happened to win out in each one of the just six numbers, and in fact, in every instance of fine-tuning. Or three, to find another table, to get very creative and to hypothesize that our universe is actually only one among many, and to suppose that in our universe, the numbers having come out right to permit life, we are, in fact, contingently able to contemplate these facts with some curiosity, but that in a lot of other universes, each with a different deal of the constants, you see how addictive this poker language is, each with a different tuning of the laws, there would not be matter or life or the contemplation of its inevitable non-existence. Well, this is structurally, I think, the Goldilocks strategy again, though it's applied here not to solar systems, but to whole other universes. And in fairness, I have to say that it's not as absurd as it might first sound to non-physicists. We know, for example, that in our universe there are things called black holes into which matter disappears forever from contact with our universe into who knows where. And there's even theoretical speculation that our universe would also allow so-called white holes from which matter might emerge as if from outside our universe into our own. And we also know enough about quantum mechanics to think, to know about so-called quantum fluctuations in which matter and energy, or even, it's speculated on the grounds of a possible quantum theory of gravity, even space and time might emerge spontaneously from nothing into our universe. In extreme but perhaps defensible versions of these speculations, we can suppose that our universe is of such a character that it can actually allow to emerge spontaneously things that might be called infant space-times, which, from our point of view, would be eruptions into our universe, but which, internal to themselves, might act like wholly new universes from an interior point of view. The relevance of this speculation to the fine-tuning problem is to suppose that our universe, the sum of all the space and time, all the matter and energy accessible to our empirical study, is itself one of these infant universes, a daughter, if you will, of some fertile and fecund mother universe. If that mother universe is of such a character as to be able to have a daughter, namely our universe, then the thinking goes that its laws would permit this to happen any number of times. So we would not be an only daughter, but one of a vast collection of daughter universes, all sisters, if you will, each existing within its own space-time. The further theoretical possibility is that each such daughter universe is, in some sense, as unpredictable as any other quantum fluctuation, and thus potentially different from its siblings to the extent of having gotten a fresh deal of different set of physical laws, a different values of physical constants, and thus a different sort of material future. So this many universes theory or speculation has the potential neatly to resolve the fine-tuning problem, keeping our universe from being special by noting that it would be just one of a vast or even infinite number of daughter universes, each of which was very literally a quantum accident, and in which, so the argument goes, we're around to conduct fine-tuning arguments only by the luck of the draw in our particular case. So you will discover, I predict, a growing popularity of this so-called multiverse theory in popular writing about physics in the years ahead, in part because it is so comfortable to those of the accidentalist school. But let me, in closing, point out to you the enormous and so far unexamined cost of this line of argument to anyone who still pretends to be a positivist, as most scientists do. Anyone who still indulges the hope that extra empirical presuppositions can be banished from science. By its nature, the multiverse theory has to hypothesize at least a mother universe and many daughter universes. The mother universe has to be hypothesized to be enough like ours to allow quantum fluctuations and even whole daughter space-times as spontaneously produced outcomes. In fact, the mother universe's nature has to be right, if not just right, to be able to explain the existence of our own. In fact, just as theologians are widely accused of having created God in man's own image, the daughter universe, by this process, has created the mother in its own image. What's more, the theory only solves the fine-tuning problem by assuming near infinite fecundity, by producing a great vast crop of daughter universes, all the offspring trying out, as it were, all possible niches in the tuning spectrum, so that one, namely ours, can be explainably seen merely to appear to be fine-tuned. Now, hypotheses of unobserved entities is an expected and generally allowed facet of any scientific process that allows a role to theory. But let me mention that we have by this point reached, or even been forced into, what I must call the positivist nightmare. all these theoretically motivated other universes, our universe's mother and all its sisters are, and in the nature of the case, must be forever immune to any kind of empirical observation whatsoever. They exist in wholly different space-times, with different physical constants, different laws, maybe even different dimensionality. They're totally foreign, non-interacting, and non-overlapping with any part of our own. They are far more foreign to our universe than any theist's view of God's relationship to our own universe. They are, in fact, as totally, more totally extra-empirical than any medieval angels dancing for space on the head of a pin. In fact, the hypothesis of multiple universe is as extravagant an offense against Occam's razor as has ever been entertained. It's a case in which we have had entities multiplied, perhaps needfully, but now so nearly infinitely, in a way guaranteed to be forever immune not only to empirical verification, but even to any conceivable form of empirical contact at all. By contrast, I'm further unable to predict, the hypothesis of divine creation will come to be seen as a comparatively conservative and theoretically economical hypothesis, because of instead of a vast, uncountable, eternal propagation of universes, some fertile, some sterile, we'll see more and more people attracted to the hypothesis of a single eternal deity, as the creed says, without body parts or passions, whose divine intent is a sufficient explanation for the properties of one universe, the one we inhabit, and have available for empirical study. Why do I dare predict a growing popularity of this school of thought? Well, within 10 years, formerly persuasive scientific arguments against the plausibility of the God hypothesis are going to have to be re-examined because they'll be applied to other ends. The argument, for example, that hypothesizing God requires the assumption of more than it was devised to explain will be seen to be equally applicable to the hypothesis of a mother universe, which explains our universe only by the hypothesis of another one, at least as complicated as our own. The argument that explaining the origin of the universe by divine creation is unsatisfactory because it leaves unexplained the origin of God will be seen to be equally applicable to the hypothesis of a mother universe. We'll soon see the agonized contemplation of infinite logical regress into the question of the ancestry of the mother universe, whether it had a mother, and what the grandmother and great-grandmother and so on were like. Infinite regress is not only applicable to the God hypothesis. And the further argument that a God hypothesis is unscientific because it's immune from empirical verifiability or disproof will soon be seen to apply with a vengeance to all the sister universes and the whole maternal pedigree of universes that we're invited to contemplate by the theorists, the theories of accidentalists. In fact, I suggest that we're going to be left with a situation that anti-positivists have all along predicted will obtain, namely, that contemplation of the empirical evidence is not going to lead to the unanimous, universally compelling, inevitable conclusions of the positivist dream. But rather, to the formulation of at least two competing schools of thought, accidentalists and specialists, if you will, each, not one, but both, with its own extra-empirical presuppositions, and each with its own antithetical interpretations of the empirical data based upon these antithetical presuppositions. The project is underway. As in 1990 it had hardly begun, by 2010 it will come, I predict, to be resolved and to the disgrace of positivism. Time will tell. Thank you for your attention, and I'm done. Do we have time for questions? I'm
welcome that.
I just want to make a comment.
Sure.
I've seen the story about the Mother Universe and the Grand Rebel Center.
Yes.
Is that an old Twilight Zone episode?
I don't know, but it does remind me of the story of the old lady who comes to the preacher about the everlasting arms of God upholding the world, and she proposes the alternative theory that the world is supported on the back of a giant turtle. And the preacher, thinking to score, asks the old lady, but what supports the turtle? And she says, "Don't think you've got me, young man. It's turtles all the way down." And in this view, it's Mother Universe's all the way up. I've even read of a Darwinian explanation that not only are there mother universes, but there's a great competition of mother universes, and the universe we should expect to see is of a character as to lead most rapidly to the production of infant universes. The fast breeders win. Now, this is serious cosmology nowadays. The Darwinian universe theory, that's the multiverse theory. So, yeah, I don't know if I get at your question, but sure, go ahead. Yes. Right.
Set of facts. And then the science changes.
Right.
The whole
right.
landscape changes.
Right.
And it seems to be like a sort of a trap.
Yep.
Trying to think that scientific evidence is the absolute.
Right. And it's a very positivist idea, by the way, that the only legitimate grounds for belief is belief based on science. And so, in some sense, it concedes the game at before the opening of play. And I think this presuppositional outlook is a very effective cure. To deny that religious beliefs' credibility depends on science, and to affirm that scientific theorizing requires pre-scientific presuppositions, and which, therefore, denies the need to have science first and religious belief second. All right, so that's the way I think it's a very wise precaution to avoid being married to any particular science of the day. And on this line of thought, it's also unnecessary, I hope.
I've got two comments here.
Yes. Sure. Mm-hmm. And others, right?
It really wouldn't give you steady state feedback, would it? Because rather than a huge creation of math,
right,
which doesn't work in the math case,
right,
and the one replaces it at a larger scale,
right,
down,
right.
Universes.
Right. 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 It might not quite be fair to call it steady state, because the supposition is that, unlike organic evolution where the daughter resembles the mother, in every daughterization event, the offspring can be wholly different, so the argument goes. That's, in fact, a necessary feature in order to explore the whole parameter space of that leads to fine-tuning. Right. But I agree, it does have some features of the steady-state theory, in that the origin event is pushed arbitrarily far back. Yes.
Right. And in fact, that's really not what the primitive
I fully agree. And maybe you know of the existence of a just published article in the American Journal of Physics, a really wonderful article pointing out that Copernicus was intending and was understood by his contemporaries not to assign the Earth some role of mediocrity, but to remove it by removing it from the center of the universe, not putting it into some anonymous, placeless region of space, but to elevate it from the sump of the universe, the basement where all the detritus would, in Aristotelian terms, descend upon it. Oh, I'm so pleased to meet you. So you'll be happy to have a pitch that you didn't have to... There it is. Thank you. It's another delight of having come to Vancouver. I'm sorry not to have recognized you. Good. We can all celebrate. If I had